Did you hear that?
What?
Things are changing. One of the newscasters apparently is pre-reported, so this script is going to be changing live.
Two-way? Oh, I'm the first one?
Guys, make sure we're not live yet. We're not live.
Welcome to another edition of Uptown Radio. I'm your host, Cecilia Blotto.
And I'm Christina Makaya. Today on the show, do voters really care about sexual misconduct accusations against politicians? And do they really influence the way people vote?
So people will say, I support Me Too. I don't think the allegations against Cuomo are legitimate.
Whole Foods is starting to open new branches throughout the city. The first one opens in the Upper East Side. But there are fears they will take business away from local grocery stores. Some loyal customers say they won't be switching alliances.
I'm here probably 12 times a day.
Really?
Not 12 times a day, but certainly 10 times a week.
And a new Broadway show, Suffs, tells the story of the suffrage movement and how American women got the vote.
And we start our new series of reflections from our reporters. All that and more after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. 15 states and the District of Columbia are joining the Department of Justice in suing Apple. They accuse the tech behemoth of stifling competition by blocking smaller rivals from accessing iPhone hardware and software. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the DOJ's suit today.
Over the last two decades, Apple has become one of the most valuable public companies in the world. Today, its net income exceeds the individual gross domestic product of more than 100 countries. That is in large part due to the success of the iPhone, Apple's signature smartphone product.
Apple argues its restrictions protect privacy and security. Details of a $1.2 trillion package to keep the rest of the federal government funded are out. Now Congress has until the end of Friday to vote on it. House Speaker Mike Johnson says he plans to invite Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address Congress. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports the move highlights a growing partisan divide over Israel's war in Gaza.
Speaker Johnson told CNBC he plans to invite Netanyahu to speak to Congress. Invitations to foreign leaders are usually issued jointly by the House Speaker and Senate Majority Leader. But Johnson has not consulted with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Republicans denounced Schumer's speech last week that criticized Netanyahu's handling of the war in Gaza and called for new elections in Israel after the war concludes. Schumer said Israel has no stronger ally than the U.S., and he welcomes the prime minister to speak to Congress in a bipartisan way. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
The State Department's evacuating more Americans from Haiti. Dozens of U.S. citizens have left Cap Haitien on a flight to Miami and in Port-au-Prince. Officials have managed to fly out 18 more Americans on helicopters across the border to the Dominican Republic. But millions of Haitians face the daily threats of killings, rape, and torture by gangs seeking to strengthen their hold in a country that for now is absent a functioning government. NPR's Zeta Peralta reports one prominent figure, a former cop turned gang leader named Jimmy Jerizier, remains at the forefront of the violence.
He has basically struck a deal with gangs who used to fight each other to now start working together to start attacking strategic places in Haiti with one thing in mind, which is to topple the government. And in some ways, to gain a seat at the table of this government in Haiti.
NPR's Ada Peralta, who recently returned to Mexico City from Haiti. U.S. stocks have ended the day higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 269 points, or more than 0.5%, to settle at 39,781. The S&P was up 16, NASDAQ up 32 points. This is NPR.
And it's on WN.
In New York, I'm Clara Bowders. A mother of four is being questioned following an apartment fire yesterday night in Washington Heights. It injured her four children, two critically. Officials say fire broke out in a women's fifth floor apartment just before 11 p.m. An 8-year-old ran to neighbors for help. Another neighbor told ABC7 the mother wasn't home when the fire started.
She went down to buy milk, and the little girl, she went and asked the neighbor for help. She grabbed the oldest one, but she couldn't reach the youngest one because the fire was already in the living room.
The two children in critical condition are 1 and 2 years old. Manhattan's largest school board district has voted in favor of a resolution which could bar transgender girls from playing on girls' teams in public school sports. The decision is non-binding. Instead, it demands the city's Department of Education hold a public review of its current policy. Since 2019, New York City's public school students have been permitted to play sports in accordance with their gender identity and not the student's biological sex. But now, the school board representing District 2, including Greenwich Village, Soho, Little Italy, and Chinatown, has voted in favor of the resolution. The audience was filled with people against the vote. Parents and members took to the stage to comment, with New York City Council member Eric Butcher by their side. The 36-year-old man involved in the subway shooting last week, where he was shot 4 times with his own gun, is facing charges for criminal possession of a weapon. He's currently hospitalized at New York Presbyterian Brooklyn Methodist Hospital in critical but stable condition. The shooter, however, won't face charges as there's evidence suggesting he acted in self-defense. And the first cherry blossoms are blooming at Brooklyn's Botanic Gardens. We'll have more on those later on today's show. It's cloudy this afternoon with temperatures around 40 degrees. For Columbia Radio News, I'm Clara Bowders.
It's Ramadan, and Muslims are fasting from dawn to dusk in observance. For some of the city's newest migrants, finding and affording religiously approved halal food is difficult. As my co-host Christina Makaya reports, one of the city's largest mosques is providing free meals and a place for Muslims to break their fast together.
New York City's Islamic Cultural Center takes up a whole block on 3rd Avenue between 96th and 97th Streets. It's after evening prayers, and hundreds of people are lining up to pick up the meal that breaks their daily fast. Waiting in line are men, most of them migrants, who rely on the center for free halal food every day for the holy month. And according to Muhammad, one of the center's volunteers, warm bowls of rice and beef are on tonight's menu.
It's for everyone. Whoever is coming, we are distributing the food every day in every Ramadan.
Muhammad says Ramadan is more than just fasting. Being observant includes caring for others, including feeding them.
It's not just not eating the whole day. It's spending more time with God. Like when we finish this work, we go to the mosque and pray to the God.
Luckily, the mosque is just a few feet away from the ICC, which makes picking up meals a lot easier for those coming out of prayer. The mosque is one of 6 around the city, working with city officials and organizations like Islamic Relief USA, helping Muslims struggle from food insecurity take part in the holiday. Meha Sayed, who advises Islamic Relief USA's CEO, says,
I know that we have increased the number of meals we're serving in New York City during this Ramadan, and that's due to the fact that, you know, 1 in 4 adults in New York City experience food insecurity.
Since last year's Ramadan, Islamic Relief USA says the number of meals it's providing is up 30%. And according to Meha, procuring halal food is not cheap.
Although it may be accessible, it is not always affordable.
But in an effort to hold the holiday's focus on community and charity, ensuring people are receiving quality halal meals is the organization's priority.
It's just a pillar of our faith to ensure that these meals are not only healthy and warm and fresh, but also halal, because we are doing things to the highest quality and providing anyone who might be breaking their fast with dignity and respect.
Behind the line of men picking up boxes of food to go, there's a small room where women are sitting down to eat. There are 4 or 5 long tables, and women of all ages are taking their seats. Some kids are running around in the background. Ashley Resto from Puerto Rico says she didn't grow up observing Ramadan.
Today's like my first day coming down here to try the food, and because my friend came with me. So doing it here just feels more special, and I just love it because it's like it's a whole community here. Like you just get to know new people, and it just makes you feel so like wholesome and like get to know everyone. It's nice.
Like Ashley, Hadija Fajri comes to the ICC to break her fast, and she's also been volunteering, helping to distribute food at mosques around the city.
Last year, I was here volunteering last year. There was not a huge line like that. It was more, you know, just people coming and getting their iftar, you know, like the taxi drivers and all of that. They will come and stop and get their iftar, do their prayer and leave. But this year is different.
With more people to feed, places like the ICC have become more critical. For people interested in volunteering or picking up a box of food, call 311 and ask about iftar on the go. Christina Makaya, Uptown Radio News. The grocery store giant Whole Foods is set to open some new locations, but they're small. These new stores will be just a quarter or half the size of a typical Whole Foods. As Clara Bowders reports, this could threaten many of the city's small, upscale grocery stores.
Grace's Marketplace is on 2nd Avenue between 68th and 69th Streets, right around the corner from where a new, small Whole Foods is set to open later this year. But store manager Felipe Juarez is not worried.
I believe the competition is always welcome, but to be honest, like, we are not afraid of competition because this is a family-run business. You can walk in any time of the day and you can chat with at least one of the owners.
This isn't your typical deli. Sure, it has groceries, but it also has a granite countertop with stools where customers can sit down to eat freshly prepared meals. And that means it may soon have to compete with the new Whole Foods. The new smaller locations will cut out lifestyle goods, but will have similar offerings to Grace's groceries and gourmet meals. Juarez has been working here for 25 years. He says there are three things that set apart Grace's from larger chains. First, customers can always find a familiar face. Next, the high quality of their food.
Let's say smoked salmon. All the big chains out there, they buy the smoked salmon like in big, big, big batches, and they freeze it. Me, I work directly with our suppliers. There is no like a middleman.
Reason number three, Juarez emphasizes Grace's Marketplace connects with small producers, which means they can offer unique products. He walks down the aisle and pulls out a package of chocolate chip cookies with salt.
This brand of cookies, when I saw it the first time, I was like, salt on a cookie with chocolate. It's something that like you don't really hear.
Despite Whole Foods' move, there are 3% fewer big chain stores in New York City compared to last year. That's according to the Center for an Urban Future, which tracks national chains. It says cell phone stores and pharmacies are shuttering, but coffee chains and retailers offering desserts are expanding their presence. Juarez is counting on customers to stay loyal, and his strategy may work. In the middle of the store at the granite countertop, Lucida Thomas is enjoying a chopped salad with her golden doodle.
Oh my God, I love it. For the restaurant, chef is my favorite. The food is the best. And we know everybody, we're like a family right here, so it's really like good.
Despite hearing about the upcoming arrival of a smaller Whole Foods nearby, Thomas is resolute. She says there's simply no substitute for Grace's Marketplace. For her, it's the connection with the staff that makes this place memorable. But for others, it's the food. For instance, Bill Siegel. He's celebrating the birthday of one of his daughters here. Siegel pulls up a photo album on his phone with only dishes from Grace's Marketplace. Almost 50 photos are of food made by the chef here.
That's the pork chop. That sauce is magnificent. I've eaten plenty of places all around the world, and there's no better.
While we're looking at his album, another customer jumps in.
You know, this is the best restaurant in the city.
I know. I've been hearing from all these people here.
Well, one more. He's really the best.
What's your name?
My name is Glenn, and I'm here probably 12 times a day.
Really?
Not 12 times a day, but certainly 10 times a week.
Whole Foods hasn't yet announced when its new locations will open. But despite its impending arrival, these New Yorkers say they'll stay loyal to their favorite corner store. For now, Clara Bowders, Columbia Radio News.
One of the the bus companies the city sued over 2 months ago has agreed to comply by halting the transfer of migrants to New York. Texan Roadrunner Charters is one of the 17 bus companies that Mayor Adams sued in January in an attempt to halt the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants from the southern border. I spoke with James Fukuda from the League of United Latin American Citizens to ask him what the lawsuit means for migrants already in New York.
So the probably non-politically correct answer is this might actually be a benefit to the people who are already in New York because it means New York has fewer people to spread fixed amount of resources over. And we'd have an upper limit on the number of people that we have to try to find permanent housing for and engage their children in school and so on and so forth.
But is this lawsuit really the best solution to the situation? As in, is one company deciding to comply with this lawsuit enough to stop the migrant influx, which seems to be the aim of Mayor Adams?
No, because it just means the other bus companies will run an extra bus per day and pick up the slack.
So do you think the migrants who were supposed to come to New York will still be able to come, or are they going to stay in Texas?
In fairness to Texas, I'm sympathetic to them. We don't know when these people are coming, what kind of problems they have when they get here, and we're expected to pay for everything. But Abbott, the governor of Texas, has just found the most evil, inhumane way to deal with it that he could.
And looking forward, how do you hope the federal government is going to respond to this?
Not a popular answer, but we can get the middle of the country involved in this too. The Department of Defense has a number of closed military bases that have barracks. Not that I would wish that on anyone, but at least temporarily, while a more humane package is put together to deal with their particular situations and help them get adjudicated one way or the other, to be admitted, get working papers, or ultimately to be sent back.
Thank you so much, James.
You're welcome.
This morning, the City Council debated the 2025 budget for health, mental health, disability, and addiction. An hour before the hearing, protesters gathered on Chamber Street to rally against what they say is a criminalization of mental health. Julia Leo was there.
From the age of 17 until her early 40s, Helen Skipper says she cycled in and out of jail.
From Rikers Island to upstate jails. Every year I was locked up or getting released. But every year I came in with unchecked mental illness, with substance abuse problems. I was never given treatment. I was never given support.
Skip says she was an addict who sold drugs. And because she didn't get the support she needed, she continued to break the law and to get arrested.
Mental illness, behavioral health as a whole, has always been criminalized. Instead of providing us treatment and support, they throw us up under the jail.
Today, Skip is joined by a crowd of dozens rallying outside City Hall. They are asking the city to invest in community support for people with mental illnesses, rather than spending money on more beds for jails. Jay Edidin is with the Women's Community Justice Association. He says the city's justice system is broken, and women are the most impacted.
So this is happening at a time when the incarceration of women is increasing at double the rate of the incarceration of men, where it's just taken off exponentially over the last decade. Nationwide, 70% of women involved in the criminal legal system have mental health diagnoses. At Rikers Island, that's actually 80%.
As an alternative to incarceration, Edidin would like to see more programs offering peer support. Skip agrees. She's working toward a PhD in criminology.
Peer support is an evidence-based practice. It has been empirically researched to work. Use us. Allow us to have a seat at the table. Your recidivism problems and carceral problems of those with behavioral health would be mitigated.
Skipper says she got help, not from the city, but she did manage to get clean.
And I haven't looked back ever since then.
Julia Leo, Columbia Radio News.
It's cherry blossom season, and as in recent years, the trees have been blooming earlier, and their peak is less predictable. Claire Davenport went to Brooklyn Botanic Gardens to learn more about these early bloomers.
It's a chilly and windy morning, a little over 30 degrees. But that hasn't stopped visitors to the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. Last week, the garden reported its first bloom, and flower enthusiasts wander over for a photo in front of the blush-colored trees. I spoke with Maggie Liu, who lives in the neighborhood. She came to beat the crowds.
Yeah, it's nice, especially on a kind of random weekday morning when there's not as many people here. Like on the weekends, it gets pretty crowded, so it's nice and peaceful right now. It's kind of fun just seeing, like the early bloomers.
Yesterday was the first full day of spring, and for many New Yorkers, the cherry tree blossoms are a sign that the seasons are changing.
Spring felt like it should have come earlier this year, but, it's still pretty chilly. We're at the end of March, so I'm hoping, once they kind of start coming up in full bloom, it'll really mean, the bad weather is over.
Lou isn't alone. According to Shauna Moore, the director of horticulture at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, cherry blossoms have been an important marker of the seasons changing since the garden opened.
The cherry tree and the cherry esplanade, just really kind of our trademark plant. I think we've had cherry blossoms here since the beginning of the garden.
Each tree only flowers for a week or so, and there's no moment when all are blooming at once. According to Moore, it's a quick life cycle.
About a six-week season, and so it starts very slowly, and right now we've got three in the collection that are blooming, and then in about 3 weeks, I think we'll probably hit a lot more.
Cherry blossoms require at least a month of winter temperatures to fully bloom. And other environmental factors can also impact their ability to thrive.
Depending on the weather, if the weather is warm and or rainy or windy, those blossoms don't last as long as they would if the nights are a little cooler and the flowers would persist a lot longer on the tree that way.
Bloom calendars posted in the garden's visitor's center still name April and May as peak bloom seasons for the cherry trees. But as the winter season in New York becomes shorter and shorter, this poster is becoming outdated. For example, last week, temperatures jumped to the low 70s, atypical for this time of year.
You know, our winters are milder. We're warming. We all know that. And the climate is changing. So everything is shifting. And we're seeing that with Mother Nature here, too, in the garden.
I asked Moore if rising temperatures could mean that one day cherry blossoms would stop flowering in Brooklyn.
I don't think so. I think cherry blossoms are pretty, are pretty resilient. And I think that would be very sad, wouldn't it?
Indeed, it would be sad. Claire Davenport, Columbia Radio News.
You're listening to Uptown Radio. I'm Christina Makaya.
And I'm Cecilia Blotto.
Coming up in the show, a minimum wage has been introduced for food delivery app drivers, but some are finding it difficult to understand their pay.
And Princess Peach, remember her from Super Mario? For the first time ever, she's going to be the hero of her own story, without those pesky Italian plumbers. But first, these headlines.
In New York, I'm Samuel Eli Shepard. Reddit's first day as a publicly traded company was, as Redditors say, an upvote. The IPO was priced at $34 and it opened on the New York Stock Exchange at $47. Reddit's debut may prove a challenge to the company, which has been experiencing losses in recent years. But some active users fear that Reddit's cash grab will threaten beloved aspects of the site. The Justice Department and 16 states are suing Apple for maintaining a monopoly over the smartphone market. Here's Attorney General Merrick Garland this morning. For example, texts from Android users appear on iPhones as a different color, and they're not encrypted. The DOJ says that these tactics are both unethical and break federal antitrust laws. Former President Donald Trump is facing yet another hurdle in trying to raise nearly $500 million in bond money. New York Attorney General Letitia James is ramping up plans to seize Trump's property, including a mansion north of Manhattan. Trump has until March 25th to come up with the money. For the first time since the Israel-Hamas war began on October 7th, the U.S. has circulated a draft of a U.N. resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The draft calls for immediate ceasefire tied to the release of hostages in Gaza. This is a significant change of tone in the Biden administration's policy, which has repeatedly vetoed U.N. ceasefire resolutions. The Israeli incursion into Gaza since October 7 has caused an ongoing humanitarian crisis in the region. Yesterday, the UN declared an imminent famine in Gaza. The ceasefire talks come as Israel prepares for an invasion into Rafah, a southern city in Gaza in which over 1 million Palestinian civilians are sheltering after fleeing the north, as well as Hamas militants. Doctors at Massachusetts General Hospital today have successfully completed the first transfer of a genetically modified pig kidney into a living human patient. This could be a solution to the national organ shortage crisis. The demand for organs in the U.S. is more than double the supply, according to the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network. This is the third time an organ from a pig has been transplanted into a living human. The first two patients, both heart recipients, died weeks after the procedure. The 62-year-old man who received a kidney was discharged from the hospital today. And, get a grip, the NCAA Wrestling Championships start today. The first round of 36 wrestlers began at noon, and national finals are Saturday at 7. For Columbia Radio News, I'm Samuel Eli Shepard.
Earlier this week, a former colleague of Mayor Eric Adams accused him of sexually assaulting her in 1993 when he was on the police force. When it comes to next year's mayoral race, Adams's two likely opponents, Scott Stringer and former Governor Andrew Cuomo, have faced similar accusations in the past. But is there a difference between how tolerant Democrats and Republicans are towards politicians accused of sexual assault? Dean Condoleo reports.
Claims of sexual misconduct against politicians are nothing new. If you're a Republican, or at least a former president, it seems like voters are quick to forgive these days.
It seems like no matter what Donald Trump does, his voters will support him.
Samantha Magic researches gender and politics at John Jay College of Criminal Justice.
Whereas Democrats, I think, tend to take sexual misconduct allegations a bit more seriously. It doesn't mean that there aren't allegations. I mean, this Democratic race in New York City shows that Democrats are equally capable of sexual misconduct, at least allegedly.
A former police colleague of Adams has accused him of demanding oral sex in exchange for his help at work. And this could mean problems for Adams. According to a 2022 Pew Research survey, Democrats are roughly three times as likely as Republicans to support Me Too. Susan Kong is a professor of political science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She says there's another layer to this, a generational divide among voters.
So I don't think it's actually a partisan line at all, because there's a lot of people out there, Democrats and Republicans, who find the cultural changes around workplace norms to be like happening too fast in a way that's like too harsh or too, like, punishing to men.
Kong says just take the case of ex-Governor Andrew Cuomo.
People kind of decided that they really liked and trusted Cuomo during the pandemic. That's sort of why he got his popularity, was from his daily briefings.
During COVID-19, frightened Americans craved information. Cuomo became a national TV star, appearing in households across the country with the latest news on the virus. And by Thanksgiving in 2020, people were purchasing cardboard cutouts of the top half of his face, letting everyone know that he was watching the number of people in private gatherings. But then, female coworkers began to come forward with Me Too accusations against Cuomo. Kong says for a while, his tremendous popularity protected him, even among Democrats who typically support Me Too.
So people will say, I support Me Too. I don't think the allegations against Cuomo are legitimate, or they'll maybe go after the attacker. So people can hold both of these positions at the same time.
While Kong asserts that people can hold both positions, when we asked New Yorkers how they felt about allegations against Adams, their opposition to him was cemented.
I don't know much about his, like, sexual allegation charges. I wouldn't vote for him anyway, but now that I know that he has sexual allegation charges, it would put me in another perspective also not voting for him.
New Yorker Kyle Wilder is a Democrat that wouldn't vote for Adams regardless of the allegations. Similarly, New Yorker Davis Green, also a Democrat, says voters need to keep allegations in mind come election season.
I was not aware of allegations of this kind, and now that there are some, that's something that voters need to keep in mind, absolutely. If it turns out that they are true, and I think the sheer fact that they have been alleged is a serious consideration at the time of kind of elective years in general, I'd say.
According to a poll from Quinnipiac University, Adams has one of the lowest approval ratings of any New York City mayor ever since they've been conducting the poll since 1996. On the other hand, although Cuomo was very popular, even that couldn't save him. Sexual misconduct allegations were a serious consideration in Cuomo's choice to resign from office 3 years ago. After 8 months and accusations from 11 women, he resigned.
The best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to governing. And therefore, that's what I'll do.
And then considering the response that Cuomo had, including Mayor Adams right now and Scott Stringer, all who might be running for mayor in 2025, what insights can be drawn regarding the strategies that political figures like them employ when facing such accusations?
Eric Adams is a weak candidate. Like, he's weak in terms of re-election. He's very unpopular. He's got historic low polling numbers. Ultimately, I'm not sure what this is going to do. He's already doing badly when it comes to the budget. He's doing really badly when it comes to migrant crisis. He's really doing very badly in terms of a number of issues. He's very unpopular. It all kind of adds up. So it's not going to be what takes him down.
Mayor Adams has already raised millions in campaign funds for a 2025 re-election. If Adams drops out of the race, Cuomo has hinted that he may run. Dean Condoleo, Columbia Radio News.
New York City is now one of the only cities in the country to pay food delivery drivers a minimum wage. As of December, delivery apps like Grubhub and DoorDash must pay workers a minimum of $18 per hour, plus tips. But as Irina Humenyuk reports, some delivery app drivers say loopholes make it hard to understand their pay.
It's a little bit before sunset at the Aja Khadi Halal Meat and Fish Market, just off 115th and Frederick Douglass Boulevard. I'm in the heart of Little Senegal. A group of Senegalese food delivery drivers are about to break their Ramadan fast. There are clusters of e-bikes and mopeds grouped around many restaurants. Serine Moudou Diouf, an immigrant from Senegal, says this is one of the only jobs he can get.
On a sans-papier. We don't have a working permit, so we work with DoorDash, but the app comes with difficulties. Sometimes we connect to the app, but we don't receive any orders. We spend 2 or 3 hours without being assigned any work.
A city law in effect late last year established a baseline hourly wage for workers with two rates, either a flat $18 an hour for all time on the clock, or $30 an hour for the trips themselves. The Consumer and Worker Protection Board of New York City says that delivery apps don't need to tell their workers which pay structure they're using. So for drivers like Diouf, it's hard to know what they're actually taking home.
But it's normally equitable. Normally, it would be fair. If you work 5 hours, you get paid 5 hours. But the apps don't do this. They don't respect the law. We don't understand why now. I can work 35 hours. My friend will work 20 hours, and he'll have a higher pay than me.
Whether it's related to the new minimum wage or not, some drivers say it just seems like people are accruing penalties more easily. On DoorDash, if you get 3 violations on your account, you're blocked from using the app forever.
The client can complain about an order, but sometimes you complete an order and the client will lie and say he never received it. There are people who aren't honest.
Another delivery app worker, Papa Bamba, says despite these complications, he's just grateful to have the work.
There is more won than is lost.
Bamba says the real problem with the apps lies in the fact that labor laws are so restrictive. Undocumented workers log on under each other's accounts all the time. They'll find someone who has a social security number and has registered with a delivery company legally. And then they'll swap this single account between several people.
You see, the guy that fulfills the order is not the one that has to pay for the spilled orders. It's the one that gave the papers for the account. It's him that has to pay.
Aaron Hatton teaches sociology at SUNY Buffalo with a focus on the gig economy. About New York City's effort to establish a minimum wage, she says,
it's a little bit like an inch forward. Increasing wages for these workers is meaningful, right? That's important. So I don't want to denigrate that in any way.
But Hatton says the real problem is that these companies are using drivers full-time, but not being forced to treat them like full-time employees.
They're not covered by the broader obligations that they have to these workers, issues around discrimination, issues around safety and liability, issues around health insurance.
According to Hatton, companies like Uber Eats argue that their workers are independent contractors because, well, they say they can start their shift whenever they want. This gives the illusion of control. Take tipping, for example.
Companies can suddenly change who sets the tips, how people leave tips. They're given like little options for tipping and how those are accessible or how low or high those are. All of those are under the company's control and they can change those at a whim. And that has very real material consequences for these workers.
So while larger questions about how delivery apps classify their workers will remain, drivers in New York City will continue to figure out how the new minimum wage laws are changing their take-home pay. Irina Humanyuk, Columbia Radio News.
New Yorkers will no longer need a prescription to obtain a year's supply of hormonal birth control. This change became official on Tuesday when the New York State Department of Health authorized the measure signed by Governor Kathy Hochul. I spoke to Rochelle Rodney, the director of the New York Birth Control Access Project, who helped make this happen. I asked her what the rollout means and what people interested in taking advantage of this decision should know.
A patient can now walk in and pick up Opill on the shelf and buy it and walk out without having to consult with anyone.
So it's just the Opill that's available without a prescription?
Yes.
And who can access this? What age groups? What's the age restriction?
There's no age restriction for the Opill.
And for parents that might be concerned about not being able to get involved in their daughter's decision to start birth control, what is something that you guys would say to them to maybe relieve some of that anxiety?
So I think that is extremely important for parents to talk to their children about sexual health and to create an environment where they're comfortable coming to them to talk about sexual health related things. But I think that on top of that, it's important to recognize like the stigma that a lot of young people face with accessing contraception. So I think that we should encourage young people to make decisions like that when they feel like they need a preventative method and that parents should support them as well.
Right. And I know that the Opill is one route that women can take, but the ring and also the patch are available. So could you clarify what the pharmacist's role is then?
Because it's a little bit confusing for people. Clarify that with over-the-counter, the patient can get the Opill. And then with pharmacist prescribed, a patient can either get the pill, the patch, or the ring from the pharmacist. And the governor announced that all pharmacists will be able to prescribe the pill, patch, or the ring to patients who walk into the pharmacy and consult with them without a prescription.
Right. So consulting the pharmacist is optional, but at women's disposal if they have any questions or concerns. But what does this mean for the future of women in New York and also the future of contraception? And how has this step changed the scope of access within the state?
So now I think that is definitely going to alleviate the 1.2 million women across New York State that do live in contraception deserts. That has been a fact that we've been working to diminish for over a year now.
What's a contraception desert?
So that is an area where women do not have the full range of contraception available to them. So they might be able to go a couple of miles from them and they can pick up like an IUD and the ring, but then they don't have an option to get like the patch or the pills.
And moving forward, what is the mission of New York Birth Control Access Project?
So right now what we're focused on is training the next generation of reproductive justice advocates and helping them to learn about the ways that they can advocate for their reproductive rights across in New York State. We're continuing to do birth control access and expanding birth control across the state in other ways as well.
Well, Rochelle Rodney, thank you so much for speaking with us today at Uptown Radio. And we really appreciate you taking the time.
Yes, no problem.
Well, thank you so much.
In the world of video games, few female characters are as recognizable as Nintendo's Princess Peach. The formula for most Super Mario games is simple. The evil King Bowser kidnaps Peach, and Mario has to rescue her. But tomorrow, for the first time in nearly 20 years, Princess Peach will be the hero of her own story. Samuel Eli Shepard.
At the Nintendo store by Rockefeller Plaza, a swaggering Princess Peach is slashing her way across the screen. She's dressed up as a musketeer in a blue cavalier hat and armed with a rapier. 20-year-old Shreya Doronala is controlling her on the Nintendo Switch.
But it's like Princess Peach, she has a lot of like powers I think she uses. Oh, this one is her sword fighting, I think, and then like I bet like in the next like other stages there'll be more.
It's one of many costume changes that the Mushroom Kingdom monarch takes in the upcoming video game Princess Peach Showtime. One moment Peach is a ninja, then a golden-voiced mermaid, than a detective.
And I want to see more of Peach because there's never been like a Peach that's been her own heroine, much less has all these amazing powers or amazing like get-ups.
Princess Peach uses these get-ups or transformations to take on the evil sorceress, Madame Grape, and her minions, the Sour Bunch, who have taken over the Sparkle Theater. In a first for a game featuring Princess Peach, the cast is all girls, and Mario, nowhere to be found. Early reviews of Princess Peach have praised the game's whimsical design, but some people are saying the game is pretty easy, which points to a double standard. Cody Meir teaches games, gender, and culture at SUNY Buffalo.
Oftentimes we see a gender breakdown between the games that are easy, and those are women and girl games that we don't take as seriously, and then we get the really hard games really gendered as masculine spaces. Those are games for boys and men that want that challenge.
Meir says that Princess Peach Showtime is a step forward for girls in gaming, albeit an imperfect one.
It's not just that anymore, right? It's like, yes, we can be mermaids and you know, sing and guide these sea creatures around, and we can also solve crimes, and we can also be swashbucklers. At the same time, yes, I think it does fall into some of that same distinction between, you know, the casual games for women and then the hardcore games for dudes.
Despite some criticisms about its easiness, a new generation of girl gamers, like 9-year-old Paige, are excited to play the game. Who's your favorite Mario character?
Princess Peach and Rosalina and Luma.
Did you know that Princess Peach is getting her own video game?
Yay! Finally!
And boy gamers, like 9-year-old Kalel, are eager to play too.
I don't know, I feel like some characters don't get their own games because they're not in the main, so I would like if Princess Peach had her own game.
Princess Peach Showtime comes out tomorrow on the Nintendo Switch. No Italian plumber required. Samuel Eli Shepard, Columbia Radio News.
A new host, a new Broadway show called Suffs, opened last week. Opens next week. The musical, supported by famous producers Hillary Clinton and Malala Yousafzai, tells the story of how American women got the vote. It was supposed to debut in 2020 for the 100th anniversary of American women's suffrage. Like many productions, it got delayed due to the pandemic. As our reporter Maureen Saint finds, the delay means the show's focus on women's rights is timelier than ever.
At the beginning of Suffs, we are transported to a meeting of suffragists in 1913. They're planning to march on Washington and disrupt President Woodrow Wilson's inauguration. We hear activist Ida B. Wells, played by Tony Award-winning actress Nikki James.
We demand to be seen. We demand to be seen. We demand.
The musical itself has been in the works for some time, since producer Rachel Sussman was in middle school working on a project on the women's movement. She learned that it spanned three generations from the mid-19th century to 1920, but not much else.
There had been about two paragraphs in my textbook on the American women's suffrage movement, and I thought there's got to be more to it than that. And I was so enamored and also frustrated, because why were these stories of extraordinary women being kept from me and other young people? Why aren't they taught to us?
8 years ago, she decided to put the lessons on stage, including one in the show's title.
What does suffs mean?
So suffs is the shorthand for suffragists. It's what they called themselves.
Jill Furman is the show's other principal producer.
You are going to learn about history that you didn't know. And I went to an all-girls school in New York. I never learned about these women.
But this season on Broadway is crowded with 18 new shows. So how do you persuade people to buy tickets for a history lesson? Luckily, Furman is a Broadway veteran with hits like Hamilton and In the Heights on her resume.
Everyone likes to keep reminding us that it's the most crowded season in 30 years.
Furman says because it takes so long to produce a show, she has to be very selective. She hopes the powerful ballads will get audiences of all ages reacting. As a viewer, it's impossible not to notice another aspect of the production: the all-female, diverse cast. And it's dramatic. Fellow producer Sussman again.
Trying to show it as a perfect movement led by these warrior women would not be accurate, right? It also wouldn't be human. They made mistakes, and we now, 100 years later, can learn from them.
The real-life suffs were far from inclusive and were made up mostly of white women. In some cases, they prevented black women from joining their marches. And that's part of the conflict historian Elaine Weiss writes about, as well as other challenges that all women faced at the time.
You see these women who had no power. They had no representation.
Thanks to the suffragists, women finally got the vote in 1920, but their rights are still often challenged today. And that's why the producers think their show is urgent.
Today we also face a very troubling erosion of women's rights and women's agency and women's bodily autonomy.
Weiss is referring to the Supreme Court, which overturned Roe v. Wade nearly 2 years ago, and the lack of women in positions of political power.
And we see that today. Even women who are entering politics are judged in a different way.
But this is Broadway, and creator Rachel Sussman says the show at least ends on a high with a new finale, Keep Marching. This song recounts when hundreds of thousands of women marched on Washington. The creators hope their finale will march them all the way to a win in this year's Tony Awards. Maureen Saint, Columbia Radio News.
And now a personal story from one of our reporters. White lies, we've all told them. You're sick to avoid a night out. You loved that soggy lasagna your aunt made. You act like you really want to see photos of your co-worker's kid. These are the white lies we tell. Claire Davenport tells when not to fess up.
The first white lie I remember telling was at the pool when I was six. That day, amid the splashing and underwater handstands, I saw my friend Molly and was horrified by her new haircut. Her bangs looked choppy and uneven, and I felt it was my civic duty to tell her. But first, I told my mom. Molly's hair looks terrible. My mom pulled me out of the pool and scolded me. You are going to go over there and tell Molly you like her hair. You are being rude. I'd never considered that saying what was on my mind might be the wrong thing to do, that it could hurt people. This was my introduction to white lies, and as I grew up, I told them more and more. I laughed at everyone's jokes. I tossed out fake compliments. I pretended to like everyone's haircut. I told myself these are the good kind of lies, not the bad kind, lying with a capital L. I kept on living this way into college. Once, I even pretended to appreciate when a date mansplained the entire plot of a movie to me. At least I didn't have to make him feel bad, and that felt great. That was how I felt until a dinner I had with my dad sophomore year. It was at a fancy restaurant, the kind that's dimly lit with items like turtle soup on the menu. It was our waitress's first night on the job, and you could tell she was nervous. While my dad was in the bathroom, she asked if I wanted wine. I didn't want to give her a complicated order, so I just asked for water. But when I didn't ask for wine, she gave me one of those knowing looks and said, "I was wondering." Wondering what? Had she guessed I was below the legal drinking age? Before I had the chance to ask, she said, "You're pregnant." I wasn't pregnant, but I panicked. I couldn't make her feel bad about implying my lacy purple dress looks suspiciously tight. So I said yes. Then she wanted to know everything about my fake baby. Was it a boy or a girl? A girl. How far along was I? First trimester. Had I picked a name? We're working on it. And right then, when I was starting to really get into it, nodding a lot, rubbing my belly, my dad came back from the bathroom and heard our conversation. He stared at me, shocked, and then at her. Then he pointed at me and said, "You must be confused. She's not pregnant." I will never forget the way the waitress looked at me. It was one of the longest silences I've ever lived through. At first, she seemed confused, then hurt. I had no idea what to say. How could I explain that I had just made up a pregnancy to avoid embarrassing her? It felt so crazy. All I could say was, "I'm sorry." Today, I still think it's important to be aware of other people's feelings, and I definitely still tell white lies sometimes. But now, I tell people if I'm just too tired to go out, if I already know the movie plot. And even, no, I'm not a fan of their new haircut. And under no circumstances do I ever pretend to be pregnant.
That's it for this edition of Uptown Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Our executive producer today was Desiree Nick-Fargem. Leading our staff of reporters was senior producer Dean Condaleo, assisted by producer Irina Humenyuk. And shaping up the edition was senior editor Dominic Hall Thomas, with the help of assistant editor Thomas Baronio.
In the studio today as the director was Zoe Yee. Fahima Degia was in charge of soundbite. In control of webcasting and social was Maureen Saint. And working the board was Pascal Hoag.
Clara Bowders and Samuel Eli Shepherd delivered our local newscast. And day reporters Julia Leo and Claire Davenport brought you the latest on the ground in New York. Today's commentary was also brought to you by Claire Davenport.
Our instructors Sally Herships, Kerry Donahue, and Priscilla Labi advised our staff. And we're your hosts. I'm Cecilia Blotto.
And I'm Christina Makaya. Uptown Radio is live Thursdays at 4, but you can always find us at uptownradio.org. Until next time, and from all of us here in the studio, thanks for listening. And we promise, no laughter next time.